breaks out, nothing but silence. From the mainstream media show, we want to know about nonviolence. Where do we go? Nonviolence Radio. Tell your friend, tell your foe.
Ooh, nonviolence.
Challenging
radio.
Silence.
Nonviolence.
Challenging
radio.
Silence.
Ooh, nonviolence radio.
Challenging silence.
Greetings, everybody. Today is Friday, May 12th, 2017, and you're at Nonviolence Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Nagler. Nonviolence is a power that all of us have within us and we all have access to, but we have to know what it is and how it works and how it's institutionalized and how we can apply it in various situations, because there's so much creativity involved in nonviolence, but everything on the mass media shows us that it's impossible, or it just means, you know, sitting in front of buildings with signs or going out and protesting or going on hunger fasts, which most people say, well, that's not really my cup of tea. So what can I do to get involved in the world? And so we like to highlight on Nonviolence Radio really what the essence of nonviolence as that inner power that we all have access to, and then show you how you can get involved in the various ways. And today we are quite excited to have Susan Kinder, who is the executive director of a local nonprofit organization in Santa Rosa called Restorative Resources. Now, why is this important? Because restorative justice is one of the keystone issues in nonviolence, meaning that when we change the way that we understand conflict and how we can resolve it and the meaning of our relationships as human beings, then we start to understand that we can back away from violent models themselves, not just violent interactions, but the violent models that we have to protect ourselves from one another, when really what we need in nonviolence is one another. So it's a great irony, and it's something that is really taking the world by storm in a lot of ways, but it's also quite, it's not as new as it seems to many of us here in the West. So we hope that Susan will be able to tell us more about this and tell us some stories about how it is effective and how it's working, especially in the Sonoma County schools, yeah, as a model. And then later in the show, we'll get into some nonviolence in the news, as our theme song says that when nonviolence breaks out, we don't hear much of it about it on the mainstream media. So we're going to fix that a little bit for us. So welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you, Stephanie. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here with you and Michael.
Let's just start off with the big question. What is restorative justice in just a few words, and then we can move on from there?
Okay. Well, I think that was a really excellent introduction that you gave, Stephanie. I appreciate that, because it's really true that restorative justice has been in the news quite a bit, but restorative justice is actually ancient. It has its beginnings in indigenous cultures all over the world, that indigenous cultures have come together to resolve conflict in a community way where all voices are heard. It was first introduced into the Western world in New Zealand. At that time, New Zealand had issues with their Maori population that our traditional system of Western justice, English justice, didn't resolve. And so they turned to the Maoris and asked them, what shall we do? And they shared, the Maoris shared their way of resolving conflict, which was to come together in a circle, all voices heard, everyone, victim, offender, community members, everyone having a voice in how to make things as right as possible. And from there, New Zealand adopted restorative justice in a broad way in its juvenile courts and now also in its adult courts, and has spread from there. There's a lot of, it's kind of spread, I would say, little pockets all over the world. Mm-hmm. It's been used pretty extensively in Africa. It was used in helping resolve the Rwandan genocides. Mm-hmm. It was used in Sierra Leone. Mm-hmm. And it was also used in South Africa and in splitting up apartheid.
Right. I first learned about the practice of restorative justice actually when I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Benin, West Africa, because I, strangely, and that I learned about it through an American film that was sent to me there about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. And at that point, I was just out of college in my early 20s, and I had no idea that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission even happened. I didn't learn that in school. And so I was astounded, and I was watching, you know, the director's clips and the writers and what, you know, what is this thing? And I think it was the director who said, no, the writer of it, she said she just wanted people to know, the reason that she wrote this, that she wanted people to know that such a thing exists.
Yes.
And from there, that's how I got interested in nonviolence. And this work. But then I've recently gone back to village in to visit my friends there. And I discovered that something that I wasn't aware of fully when I was there for 2 years was that they have a very intricate restorative justice culture already available. So they have the village chief who's there to resolve disputes among families. And then they have another person who's designated to resolve disputes between individuals who aren't necessarily related. And at a point when I was there, I remember that feeling of being angry with a friend of mine from village. And somebody said, you know, you have to forgive this person. And I'm like, why? Why should I do that? This is, and their answer was because we all live together. And this is, you know, we in this culture where we live in, where people are moving around and we don't have those deep relationships, restorative justice seems a bit foreign. But when you are there and you're stuck together, you need to find something else. You're not where you're not going to send people away and create greater community resentment. So I think that's, I love restorative justice, and I'm extremely fascinated by it.
Well, I am too, and I'm getting a big idea about the item that you led to and Stephanie just enlarged on. I remember hearing a talk by Helena Norbert Hodge many years ago. I was working in Ladakh, and there was an amazing episode in the village where somebody stole a sack of rice from a family. And that could mean the difference between life and death over the year, you know. And so Helena said, gosh, how are we going to find out who stole it? And they said, oh, we know who did it. And so Helena said, well, then what are you going to do about it? Nothing. What can I do? If I do anything to that person, I'll spoil the relationship. And we have to live together. So the idea that's occurring to me is that in these indigenous communities, restorative justice was not an option. And we think it's an option. Mm-hmm. We think we can go on alienating people and punishing them. And
retributive justice.
Retributive justice.
You said restorative justice is not an option in these villages.
Well,
did you mean? I don't know.
No, yeah, I meant it, that they have no choice but to do restorative justice. Mm. Oh, yeah, it's not an option in the sense they have to do it. The retributive justice is not an option in the sense that they can't use it. They would destroy their mm-hmm. relationships. Mm-hmm. And that's everything in mm-hmm. those small communities. But I think we're starting to realize that it's just as important for us. So we're being pushed up against the wall. And, I mean, people like us, we want restorative justice because we're drawn to it. It's a beautiful thing. It expresses something very profound about human relationships. But other people who may not see it that way are being forced to adopt it anyway.
Well, I don't know that people are necessarily being forced to adopt it, but I certainly resonate with what you folks are saying about, you know, this thing about being stuck together or being together. I mean, we're all together. We're on this planet, and we can't, you know, there's really no such thing as getting rid of people or throwing out problems. I think in our criminal justice system, you know, we can't just put people in prison and therefore they're no longer part of our community. I mean, our community includes everyone. And we have to learn how to deal with that. And restorative justice is a way to resolve conflict in the greater community.
Mm-hmm. And now I want to look at that question of the relationships underneath, Susan, because mm-hmm. it seems to me that when we understand that, the whole spectrum of how restorative justice works opens up. So you mentioned victim and offender. What's the relationship between victim and offender when it comes to restorative justice versus retributive punishment model justice?
Well, in the traditional criminal justice system, which is the retributive model, mostly the victim has no voice. You know, that the crime in that crime in a criminal justice in our traditional system is against the offender, against the state. And that comes from the old English law where it was the offender against the king. And so now it's the victim really is marginalized and again isolated from this. So and let alone the community. I mean, the community, other than sitting on a jury where they're very, you know, where there's a lot of rules about how they can decide what to do, really the community is isolated. It really comes down to the criminal justice system and the offender. In a restorative justice setting, everybody who's impacted needs to be included. And impact is broad. Impact, I mean, if you're a victim of a crime, if your house is broken into, I mean, you're impacted, obviously, your offender's impacted, but your neighbors are impacted, your kids are impacted, your brother that lives across the state is impacted. There isn't anybody that's touched. I mean, everybody is touched by crime in the community. So everybody needs to have not only a voice, but some accountability for helping resolve that situation.
That's we're talking with Susan Kinder, Executive Director of Restorative Resources in Santa Rosa. Susan, that's interesting to me that you focus on the idea that the victim has no voice in the criminal justice system, in the retributive model, because my sense is every time that I think about restorative justice, I feel like it's the victim's voice alone that is honored in that system, and that we don't understand really what was facing somebody who has violated the terms of society that brought them to that place. Mm-hmm. So can you comment about that a little bit of trying the way that restorative justice, can it help us to unpack what's going on for the person who did the offense?
Yeah, there are throughout all restorative justice, there are kind of the basic questions that are used for the most minor, but also for the most serious conflicts. And the first one is simply that everyone has an opportunity to tell their story. And it's not the reading of the police report. It's not the facts, or as someone would like, the facts presented. Rather, it's just, here's my story and what happened. Everyone has an opportunity to tell how they were impacted by the incident. And then together, everyone has a voice, and we use circles. We use circles because everyone can see each other. We don't forget about people. We often use talking pieces in order to give respect to the person who is talking. So everyone has an opportunity to share how they think this might be made as right as possible. And that includes the victim, but it also includes the offender. Includes the offender, what he or she might do to make things as right as possible. Includes community members. Includes law enforcement. And together, this group puts together a plan to make things right as possible.
Do you have any stories of restorative justice in action in the work that you've been doing with restorative resources in particular?
Sure. We have stories every day. Mm-hmm. A story that I like that I tell because it really touches me and still does. Sometimes I kind of get teary-eyed just thinking about it. But we are referred young offenders by the juvenile justice system in Santa Rosa, in our county seat. And this young man was referred to us. The incident was that he was driving his car I'll call him Eduardo. That wasn't his name, but Eduardo was driving, and he had a car full of other youth, and they were having a good time talking and so forth, and Eduardo accidentally hit an elderly woman who was crossing the street. And the woman was not injured, very fortunately, but she was knocked down, and she was obviously very frightened. Law enforcement was called, and they called her daughter. Her daughter was, you know, a woman in her 60s. And she came and, you know, helped her mother and so forth. Mm-hmm. So the restorative conference included Eduardo and Eduardo's parents. It included the elderly woman and her mother. It included our organization was called to facilitate it. And, you know, we would also help them work through the process. In this particular incident, for a more formal restorative conference, there would have been a meeting beforehand with Eduardo and his parents, and also a meeting with the victim and the victim support. You know, we would never introduce a victim to a situation where further harm might be caused. So we need to know that in advance people are ready for the conversation. And so in the conversation, as I recall, the elderly woman didn't say very much, a little bit, but her daughter really talked about how she had felt when she got that phone call. You know, from law enforcement, you know, how she was so frightened for her mother, you know, all the things that would go through a person's, anybody's mind. And so Eduardo, at the restorative conference, he apologized to the woman and to the families. But afterwards, and they put together a plan, I think, that was, you know, about him making amends. But the thing that really struck me about this particular incident was that Eduardo began to turn his life around. Mm-hmm. He had been involved in kind of some pre-gang activities. He wasn't a gang member, but he had kind of been flirting with gangs, and the boys in the car that had been with him were also kind of like that. And his parents had, in fact, they expressed at the conference that they were very, very concerned about his activities and what was the direction that he was taking his life. And so Eduardo began to turn his life around and began even talking to the kids that he knew and, you know, saying that he didn't want to be in a gang and so forth. And when somebody asked him what happened, you know, why his big change, and he said, that lady could have been my grandma. You know, but yeah, so that's what touches me too. But I mean, that's really what restorative justice is about. It's about people just coming together as humans, you know, just realizing that all of us are really the same. And, you know, in this, it gives us, restorative justice gives us a way to be human together. And in a very kind of a formal, kind of a, you know, a not risky situation, that we're allowed to talk and understand.
For those of you just tuning in, you're at Nonviolence Radio, and we're talking with Susan Kinder, Executive Director of Restorative Resources, a nonprofit organization in Santa Rosa, California, doing big work in restorative justice. And she's just sharing a story about restorative justice in practice, and said this restorative justice gives us an opportunity of being human together. And that's a really powerful statement, Susan.
Yes, I agree, Susan. I really loved listening to that. And I wanted to say, we're doing a film on nonviolence. And so we've interviewed quite a few people who are quite prominent in the field from all over the world, all stations of life. And you'd be amazed how many times I have heard nonviolence is the way that you can be an artist with your humanity, as one of them said. Isn't that mm-hmm. nice?
Yes.
And I'm reminded over and over again that Martin Luther King said, we must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented civilization to a person-oriented civilization. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the thing could be an institution, not a physical object. So when we were thing-oriented in the old criminal justice system based on retribution, as you pointed out, the crime was against the state. And in the restorative justice system, it's the human individuals that matter. But then, of course, you go from there. When you think about what a human being is, there's this concept of Ubuntu, that we have to be human together. We can't be human as individuals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that all offending is a kind of alienation. And the person, as you were suggesting, has to be alienated in some way before they do that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know our friend Azim Kamisa. His son was murdered in a gang initiation in San Diego. And it took him a lot of deep meditation and so forth to recover. But when he did, his motto became, I see victims on both sides of the gun.
Yes, that is really true. Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Susan, could you say a little bit more about what exactly you do? You've told us quite a bit already that there's a pre-conference with the victim and the offender.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're brought together, mm-hmm. and eventuates in an agreed-upon solution. But is there more to the technology that we should know about?
Oh, yes. Yes. There's a lot of practices, and there's a lot of ways that we're working in the community. In a restorative conference, for example, where a victim has really been impacted, we might, like a vehicular manslaughter, we might have one of our staff facilitators handle that. But we also use volunteers and train volunteers to facilitate restorative conferences. We want to include the community. We're very active now in the schools in Sonoma County, but also outside our county. Nationwide, the schools have been looking for an alternative to expelling and suspending students. And restorative justice now is an evidence-based, recognized practice that can be used for that. And so in a school setting, you would see a student have a restorative conference, perhaps with other students facilitating, or certainly in the community, and would be accountable for the harm they may have caused. Again, bringing people together who have been impacted, like a teacher. You know, a teacher and a student talking directly about how a student was disruptive or offended a class. And this can go all the way, you know, from 12 down to K. And it's a lot simpler process in the early grades, but it's very similar. But the thing that has happened in the schools, too, is that the schools found out, which we all find out, is that a restorative conference works and it's helpful, but returning to the same environment, an environment where, you know, punishment is kind of the rule, or people not talking, you know, not where we're not relating to each other, where we're out of relationship with each other, it's a temporary fix, you know, that we really need to go back and fix the whole of it.
So Susan Kinder, Executive Director of Restorative Resources, what you're pointing out is that the work needs to expand so that we're not just taking people out of a setting, making them restore relationships in a small scale, and then everything that they've gained, they go back into the society that we've created in our institutions, school systems, communities, where people tend to be separate and have different views of each other, and there's not a sense of working together, of building a deeper understanding of each other. How do you see that work coming forward from these conferences into, say, a community? Mm-hmm. What do you think?
A primary part of what we're doing now is training in schools. Mm-hmm. We train teachers and administrators, and we help them put together implementation teams for training and furthering the work in their schools. Mm-hmm. What that might look like are community building circles in the classroom, where students share with each other what's really happening in their lives. They have a voice. You know, they can see each other and feel a part of the classroom community and then can feel a part of the school community. And I think we're also helping those students to gain a way of feeling a part of the larger community as they grow and mature. And there are many, many schools and schools in Marin County, I understand, that are also actively engaged in restorative practices in their schools and also in Sonoma County.
Is there a sense, Susan, that the people who have gone through the restorative circle, is it restorative circles in particular? I don't want to throw terms around that I know are quite specific in the field, maybe that are part of the restorative justice movement.
Mm-hmm.
Are they aware that they are on experiencing something that is the cutting edge of our justice system, and that is there a sense of a greater, that I've participated in this process, I'm one of few people who have had this opportunity, even though the few is quite a large number, but in relation to our general society, is there a kind of a sense of we're in this together and maybe networks of people, networking people who have come through
yes.
these systems? Yes.
Yeah, yes, there is. Mm. I think there are several national organizations that are connected together. We're not part of any larger institution, but we certainly would view ourselves as part of the restorative justice international movement.
Mm-hmm.
And what is great about it is that it's really very little difference. You know, we can talk with people from the UK about what they're doing, and we'll find out they're doing exactly what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
The practices are very similar.
What I guess I'm thinking about, Susan, are the people that have gone through the practices. Does the support end after they go through the process, however long that is, some weeks, mm-hmm. weeks long, months long? Sometimes years, I imagine. And then when the process is finished officially, is there a place where they have, for example, in Buddhism, there's Sangha or Satsang, you know, or support group. Is there where they can keep kind of coming back and debriefing about how things are going? Is there something like that that you know about?
It's probably not in the criminal justice system, but I think in the schools, you know, there are. I think mm-hmm. certainly there are, you know, kind of growing groups of practitioners in the schools that
yeah.
are connected.
Hmm. Okay. It's interesting. Thank you for answering that. I'm interested in that because as the Meta Center, it's looking at ways for bringing restorative justice into Petaluma schools, which I hope we'll be able to talk about, if not on this show, then after the show, and we can highlight that certainly later. What's the broader picture? And that's actually extremely informative, and,
mm-hmm.
and because there's so much. That's what I love about nonviolence and conflict resolution and restorative justice is that it's kind of new to us. So there's a lot of work to get done.
Yeah, it's definitely new. And what we're also seeing is a lot more interest in the universities. We have a lot of relationships with, at Sonoma State, the Department of Criminology, mm-hmm. the Psychology Department, Public Affairs. Mm-hmm. In fact, we just recently had a conversation with the Center for Sustainability at Sonoma State that they've been interested in environmental sustainability, but now are kind of broadening their scope to include, community sustainability.
Beautiful. We're talking with Susan Kinder, Executive Director of Restorative Resources, and we left you there on a bit of a cliffhanger. So, Michael, I encourage you now to make your request.
Help! Hanging here on this cliff.
Yeah.
So in terms of a long-range scheme to do the building out of the principles of restorative justice to a whole community, mm-hmm. a whole world, because as you were speaking, I was reminded of these many experiments that have taken place, for example, in Israel-Palestine, where youth on both sides come together, they play soccer, they get to be wonderful friends, and then guess what? The Israeli kids go back and join the army, the IDF, and the Palestinian kids go back into the refugee camps. So this is clearly what we need to do with this wonderful development, this wonderful experiment. So my thought was, if we could develop as a norm restorative justice in the schools, which is quite doable because people tend to care more about their children than about, you know, someone having criminal activity in the street. So if we get it established in the schools and then explain why it works so well, explain the principles that are involved and how it fits into a new concept of humanity and who we are, then move on the jails, on the criminal justice system itself. And when we've established it there, and I don't know how long it would take to do all of this, when we've established it there, then I think we could go anywhere with it. We could even talk about the international community and the war system. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to me that in nonviolence, one of the things we want to do is have a doable, winnable project that scales up to bigger projects. So I wanted to get your thinking about that.
Well, I certainly give you my blessing.
Thank you. This was kind of a put-up, wasn't it?
Well, I think that it's interesting that you bring that up, because when I first started doing, being involved in the work, I thought, wow, the criminal justice system needs so much reform, and, really wanted to hit that hardest. But what I've now come around to is that the schools are really ready. And the schools, that's punishing kids is not what teachers want to do, not what schools want, are trained to do. They want to educate. And in order to educate, they have to have a community working together. So I think the schools are a beautiful place to start.
Well, I want to challenge this idea. One thing that the listeners know about me is that I'm also currently a preschool teacher in a local Montessori school in Petaluma. And what I find is that that we take for granted that restorative justice is happening in the homes, even though the relationships themselves, there is a restorative element in it, but people still do get kicked out of families for not doing for not being the way that the parents would hope you would be. Or there's these unconscious ways of handling conflict in families that we inherit from being raised unconsciously in systems of punishment. So the sense of isolating you when you are doing something that's undesirable, that's deemed undesirable in the family. So there's restorative justice. Sorry that I'm floundering here for some words, but how do we begin restorative justice in the home? Because because these unconscious ways of punishing children they're just our sort of go-to way for handling conflict. So you're having a fit, leave, go to your room, lock you up in there, or you're in there, and then you can leave when I say you can. So the parent becomes like police, jailer, and jury.
Yes, whether they
mean
they
to
think
or not. Yeah.
They think they're doing the right thing. I think that's a really hard question, because I think, as a lot of educators will agree, it's really hard to educate the parents. And, I think one of our current initiatives is giving the kids a bigger voice.
Mm-hmm.
Even at the early ages, we're helping teachers design trainings where kids are teaching parents. Let's have a circle at home. That the kids can be the leader. That's one way. Another way that we're trying to move that forward is, again, through the university. We're currently training professors. We train in the School of Education. We started off in secondary. We're now going to be working in elementary at Sonoma State at School of Education in the fall. And it's our hope and the university's hope that we could also move to the early childhood education portion of the university. I think you're absolutely right. To change it in our homes is the biggest challenge, but also the best challenge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Michael?
This is why, incidentally, I placed emphasis on articulating the principle. Because when a restorative justice episode works, if we could use that as an opportunity to explain why it works, that it has something to do with human nature, then I think it would be easier to spread.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we attended a conference down in Southern California where there was one administrator who had been adamantly opposed to restorative justice in his school. He said, "It'll never work here. My school is way too tough." And then he became one of the greatest supporters. Mm-hmm. And they asked him what was the big shift. And he said, "Every time I did the standard method, I lost a relationship. Mm-hmm. And every time I do restorative justice, I gain a relationship." Mm-hmm. And you were saying before that restorative justice could facilitate education, could make it possible. But I must think that the restorative justice is the education.
Yeah.
Well, so you're listening to Nonviolence Radio, and we're talking with Susan Kinder, Executive Director of Restorative Resources. And this has been a fascinating interview, and I know that we could talk a lot longer. So let's let people know where they can get information about the work that you do. Is there a website?
We are www.restorativeresources.org. We do have an introductory evening coming up on May 17th, very soon. It's Wednesday, and you can find more about it at our website. But it's a really fun evening. It's just about what is restorative justice, what are restorative practices, you know, how you can get involved. It's usually a couple of hours. And it's $25, but we never turn anyone away. Mm-hmm. So we would certainly, you know, that's a really great way to get a little bit more familiar with us.
Absolutely. And Susan, for our listeners, would you be able to describe perhaps one skill that they can take away with them from this show that they can maybe put into practice to try out, just one little tidbit of something that if they did more of this, then they would be helping to create that restorative culture that we're looking at?
Yes, and it's also something really hard, mm-hmm. and that is listening.
Yeah.
I think that, just to step back and instead of giving the answer is to listen to what's happening, whether it's your child, your friend, your husband, your wife, you know, just whoever. It's that listening skill.
Mm. And you've certainly, I can feel the power of your listening as we're talking and you're looking directly at me, and there's that sort of a depth to it, and it's almost startling. It's nice to encounter. So thank you very much, and thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having. Thank you very much, Stephanie and Michael. It was just a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, you're not gone yet, so you're still with us.
Oh, I'm not gone because I have more I'd like to say.
Sure, yeah. Well, let's keep talking. We want to segue into a little bit of news, but your mic is still on, so you're welcome to hop in with anything anytime.
Well, I'd just like to tell you where the latest direction, and I think it's coming from a lot of, you know, the interest. It is coming from the interest in the community. And we're moving toward what we call restorative community. Mm-hmm. And restorative community includes the schools, includes the criminal justice system, but includes other aspects of our community. One project that we're hoping to get new funding for very soon, but it would be working in the town of Guerneville, that we would be receiving referrals for complaints about homeless persons from law enforcement. And then we would have what we describe this restorative conference between a homeless person, the person who complained, community members, and law enforcement, and again, talk about our relationship and how we can make things better. And we see this as it's community building. It's getting to know each other. It's saying, yes, we are all in this town together. We want to make this work. And so that is what we're, you know, looking to as restorative community and in the homeless area, but also in other areas. You know, we've also, for example, we do circles, listening circles between citizens and members of law enforcement, and talk about issues that come up that citizens are concerned about. But again, it puts a face on the person, face on the homeless person, face on the cop, mm-hmm. and the citizen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. the one of the nonviolence principles that you're engaging there is delabeling.
Yes.
You know, you strip the label off the person, see them as a human being, and then really almost anything can be solved. Now, what you talk about is a fairly articulate profession with a lot of structure. People, you're saying, can pick this up, just the basics of it, which is just basically comes down to listening to everyone who has a stake. And then,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it works. We teach it for preschool. You know, I mean, I've seen, for example, in the kindergarten schoolyard, they put together a circle of chairs and invite kids that are having a conflict on the playground, which is, you know, mother of all conflicts. You know, that to have kids come together. And kids will themselves go to the circle. And they'll say, okay, you know, what happened? Everybody shares. Everybody says, you know, how they were impacted or how did it matter to you? Mm-hmm. What should we do? Okay, well, you know, Sally's going to let Jane play. And so then they go back and play. So, you know, children so quickly understand that this is, okay, we can do this. We can get over it. We can move on.
I know. At our playground, we have and in our classroom, we do have restorative justice. We do practice restorative justice, and we even say a Pledge of the Earth. And in the Pledge of the Earth, when it says economic justice, we've added restorative justice to our our pledge. And so the children use a peace rose, where if there is a problem, they'll go and pick up the rose and bring it to the other child and practice using their words about what happened. And then when they do that, they feel like they've regained security and trust in the process. And that's a really important part. But boy, sometimes this isn't easy. It does take a lot of work. And I have to say that it's quite challenging with a lot of the media that is being unconsciously shared with children without any discrimination about the ways that conflicts are resolved in them. Mm-hmm. So I've seen so many children's books that have been brought into the classroom, one recently, where there's this idea of the scapegoat in it, that if you just get this person out of the community or you prove yourself through some violent act, even if it seems valiant, it's still a violent act, mm-hmm. then you become fully human through that violence. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, it's in every Disney movie, it's in so much media, and so it is harder to make that the go-to response in a lot of situations. Sometimes right away somebody's kicked out of a playgroup, and then somebody, you know, they have to stop and pause and think, what is the higher reaction here and how can we do it? So yeah, there's a lot of work to do in terms of work with children and also just being discriminating in terms of the kind of media that they're having. I wish there were restorative justice media for kids.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we should work on that. As I was just thinking, as the shortest kid in public school, 193 in Brooklyn.
You remember it still.
Oh, boy. How I could have benefited from restorative justice.
Yes.
But should we move on?
Let's move on. And I guess one thing that ties this together for me as well is that so much work that happens under the name of nonviolence is also work that is about scapegoating. It's about the kinds of signs that we see are, you know, us versus them kind of politics. So that's also why we say that restorative justice is a kind of a keystone issue, because people who are going into peace work with an open heart and they want to get involved in protest work, they find that the space doesn't feel safe to them because there's so much othering happening. Do you have something to say about that, Susan, or just?
I was just nodding because it's really hard. I mean, you know, in our current political environment to, you know, think about coming together with people that we disagree with, you know, that becomes challenging.
Mm-hmm. And it's still within a realm of this idea of this practice of restorative justice. Right. Yeah.
I think that may be the most challenging and the most useful application of restorative justice in our country today. Mm-hmm. That if we could, you know, kind of suture up this divide and hear one another, people have been telling me for years that we need to reach out, and I'm saying, no, you know, we'll just articulate our ideas.
Talk to people who agree with us.
Yeah. Surely everyone will be immediately won over.
Or talk to all the people who feel like they, like that we all share the same, that we share the same problem without including the people who are considered the offenders and trying to understand why they're doing the offending without mm-hmm. labeling them.
Yeah, this is making me think of Harold Gilligan's work. Mm-hmm. There, he was a forensic psychiatrist, and he worked with the most, I don't know what to call them, the people who had really committed serial homicide. They were the most difficult people to get through to and to win back. And he said there's not a single act of violence that is not caused by a sense of one's loss of respect. That wow. when one is humiliated, one acts out violently. And he came to feel after 25 years of this work that all violence has at its root an attempt to gain respect.
Wow.
And when you think that, you know, restorative justice gives respect to each person, each stakeholder who's involved, in that way, it's an example of what we call in nonviolence, or anyway, what I call work versus work. In other words, that even if it doesn't, quote, work, unquote, and I know restorative justice almost always does, but let's say you didn't get to a successful resolution. Still, the fact that you brought people in together to listen to each one of them in an equal way has said something that's going to stay with people and be built upon from there.
Yes.
So, Michael, there's used to be there's a program like 60 seconds, and the clock is ticking, tick, 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 tick. Yeah. You have about you don't have 60 minutes. You have more like 60 seconds. So, give us a little bit of a rundown okay. of what's happening in nonviolence in the news, because yeah. we get to be really hopeful. We know all of the work that's happening in the world that mm-hmm. is trying to build up the nonviolence yeah. movement worldwide. So there's really a lot to be hopeful about, and we want to share that as a service with others. So,
and I want to say that fortunately, though I'm not going to get through more than 10% of what I had to share today, we are going to put it up on our web. We now have a wonderful volunteer, Angela Davis, who's helping me.
Angela Davis.
Angela Parker, sorry.
Gosh, I was impressed.
Whoa. You know, I think you'd be almost as impressed with Angela Parker.
I bet if
you
know. I
to, you know, take the news items that we have collected over the two-week period and put them into a format that can go on our website, metacenter.org. Now, there's one item in the news this week which must not be omitted, and that has to do with MetaCenter itself. Mm-hmm. And that is to share with everyone that a few days ago we learned that Meta has been given consultative status with the United Nations.
Oh, my goodness.
Yay.
Yeah. Wow. That's fabulous.
Yeah.
Wow.
I wish you could hear the cheers coming from the front room now here at KWMR. But, you know, that means...
that is awesome.
Isn't that
yeah.
wonderful, Susan? So
and
that
we
means...
hope we will bring restorative... We will definitely yep. bring restorative justice into that strategy. So we'll have
yep.
to talk more about
okay.
that.
Okay.
Yep. So, you know, we are ready to move up to yes. international conflict resolution.
Yes.
That all I need to do is just listen to us. Well, I think maybe what I'll do is just pick one item from each of the three categories that we usually use, resources, news, and events.
Okay, you have about 3 minutes.
Okay. We've heard about one event already, your upcoming trainings, mm-hmm. which was on my list. I'll show you if you don't believe me. And we've heard about one news item, but I'm going to add others. So in the way of resources, there is another community radio station I'd like to isolate here. And in the a friend Nathan Schneider, whom I've known for many, I actually have knew him since he was like 5 years old. But anyway, he works with the Colorado Co-op's Study Circle, which is anyway in itself an example of how communities can, in the grassroots, rebuild and restore, if you will, American culture. And they have a radio show, a monthly community. He has a monthly community show called the Co-op Power Hour,
yeah.
bringing up the idea that nonviolence is power, which is very important. And they have a feed, and you can sign up for hearing commentary on Black Lives Matter, co-op education, business conversions. Very important sector there. And this is on KGNU, Community Radio, and it airs on the fourth Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. I assume that's local time. And it's part of a weekly show called It's the Economy, famous phrase from American politics. So for the recent episodes, you can go to coloradocoops.info/radio. Okay, there was one category. As far as news is concerned, I'd like to share with you a scoop, actually, because we have some friends in the field. One of them is a man named Rajiv Vora, who works with an organization. Now, I'm talking about North India. He works with an organization called Swaraj Peet, which means Freedom School, actually, like the one in the South. And he's working in one of the most difficult areas in the world in terms of conflict, and that is Jammu and Kashmir. And what he's using is a book called Hind Swaraj, which was Gandhi's, I guess, his classic compendium that he wrote in one journey in 1909. And just to quote, he was at a very important meeting recently with high-level men in security, police, defense, and so forth. And one of them said, a senior member said, "I could not believe that such a Gandhian approach was possible." And he has headed off a lot of youth who are heading for the equivalent of gangs there. And incidentally, there is a new book on Hind Swaraj, which shows beautifully how, although very few of the particular suggestions of Gandhi have been picked up, there's something about that book which is making it into a kind of roadmap for the modern world.
Okay, Michael, pick one more piece of news before we send people to the website for more information.
Okay. There are two interesting giveaways that have happened recently where people have given land to Native Americans. One of them is a farmer, rancher named Kenneth Lindy. He's 86 years old, who gave away a lot of half of his property after he would be in community with his neighbors for 50 years. And there's a beautiful statement by the chief, Charlene Bellow. "Our children have asked us to be able to leave behind any pain and hurt, to be able to be responsible and move ahead, to take care of our lands, take care of our resources, take care of our waters for them, so that when they grow up, they are going to be ready to take on this responsibility." And I see this again as a great example of work versus work, because all of this stuff comes from what happened at Standing Rock, which, quote, failed, unquote. Thank you very much, and go to our website, metacenter.org, where you will shortly see the rest of the news of nonviolence for this week.
So this is a show of cliffhangers then, Michael Nagler. So we are listening to Nonviolence Radio. We had a great show where the phrase that stood out to me was that restorative justice is about being human together. And we had Susan Kinder here with us in the studio, and we want to thank her again. She's the executive director of Restorative Resources. We want to thank our mother station, KWMR, to all of our listeners, all of the staff and volunteers at the Meta Center, and everyone. Till the next time, take care of one another and let's be human together.
It's my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run a risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work it out. Think of what you're saying. You can get it wrong and still you think that it's all right. Think of what I'm saying. We can work it out and get it straight. Life is very short and there's no
chance that we might.